Chapter 4. Exhale. Every morning at 9, after Olsen and I finish our testing and split off for solo time, I roll out a mat and work on becoming a little more immortal. The path to everlasting life involves a lot of stretching, back bends, neck bends, and twirling, each one a holy and ancient practice that had been passed down from one Buddhist monk to another for the past 2,500 years. Olsen and I need this stretching. Even if we breathe through our noses 24 hours a day, it won't help much unless we've got the lung capacity to hold in all that air. Just a few minutes of daily bending and breathing can expand lung capacity, and with that extra capacity, we can expand our lives. The stretches, called the Five Tibetan Rites, came to the Western world and to me by way of writer Peter Kelder, who is known as a lover of books and libraries, words and poetry. In the 1930s, Kelder was sitting on a park bench in Southern California when an elderly stranger struck up a conversation. The man, whom he called Colonel Bradford, had spent decades in India with the British Army. The colonel was old, a jumble of sloping shoulders, gray hair, and wobbly legs, but he believed there was a cure for aging, and it was locked in a monastery in the Himalayas. The usual mystical stuff occurred up there. The sick became healthy, poor became rich, old became young. Kelder and the colonel stayed in touch and shared many conversations. Then, one day, the old man hobbled away, desperate to find the Shangri-La before he drew his last breath. 4 years passed until Kelder received a call from the building's doorman. The colonel was waiting outside. He looked 20 years younger. He was standing straight, his face vibrant and alive. His once balding head was covered in dark hair. He'd found the monastery, studied the ancient manuscripts, and learned restorative practices. He'd reversed aging through nothing more than stretching and breathing. Kelder described the techniques in a slim booklet titled The Eye of Revelation, published in 1939. Few people bothered to read it. Fewer believed it. The yarn was likely fabricated or, at minimum, grossly exaggerated. However, these lung-expanding stretches, Kelder described, are rooted in actual exercises that date back to 500 BC. Tibetans had used these methods for millennia to improve physical fitness, mental health, cardiovascular function, and, of course, to extend life. More recently, science has begun measuring what the ancient Tibetans understood intuitively. In the 1980s, researchers with the Framingham Study, a 70-year research program focused on heart disease, attempted to find out if lung size really did correlate to longevity. So they gathered 2 decades of data from over 5,000 subjects, crunched the numbers, and found the greatest indicator of lifespan wasn't genetics. It wasn't the diet or even the amount of daily exercise we got. It was lung capacity. The smaller and less efficient lungs became, the quicker subjects got sick and died. The cause of deterioration didn't matter. Smaller meant shorter. Meanwhile, larger lungs equaled longer lives. Our ability to breathe full breaths was, according to the researchers, literally a measure of living capacity. By 2000, University of Buffalo researchers ran a similar study comparing lung capacity in a group of more than 1,000 subjects over 3 decades. The results were the same. What nobody addressed, however, was how a person with deteriorating lungs might heal and strengthen them. There were surgeries to remove diseased tissue and drugs to stem infections, but no advice on how to keep lungs large and healthy throughout life. All the way up to the 1980s, the common belief in Western medicine was that the lungs, like every other internal organ, were immutable. That is, whatever lungs we were born with, we were stuck with. And as these organs degraded with age, the only thing we could do was sigh and bear it. Aging was supposed to go like this. Starting around 30, we should expect to lose a little more memory, a little more mobility, and a little more muscle with every passing year. We would also lose the ability to breathe. bones in the chest would become thinner and collapse inward. Muscle fibers surrounding the lungs would weaken and prevent air from entering and exiting. All these things reduce lung capacity. The lungs themselves shrink about 12% from the age of 30 to 50 and will continue declining even faster as we get older. If we make it to 80, we'll be able to take in 30% less air than we did in our 20s. We're forced to breathe faster and harder, and these breathing habits lead to chronic problems like high blood pressure, immune disorders, and anxiety. But what the Tibetans have long known and what Western science is now discovering is that aging doesn't have to be a one-way path of decline. The internal organs are malleable, and we can change them at nearly any time. Freedivers know this better than anyone. I learned it from them years ago when I met several people who had increased their lung capacity by an astounding 30 to 40%. Herbert Nitsch, a multiple world record holder, reportedly has a lung capacity of 14 liters. That's more than double the average male. Neither Nitsch nor any of the other freedivers started out this way. They made their lungs larger by force of will. They taught themselves how to breathe in ways that dramatically change the internal organs of their bodies. Fortunately, diving down hundreds of feet is not required. Any regular practice that stretches the lungs and keeps them flexible works. Even moderate exercise like walking or cycling has been shown to boost lung size by up to around 15%. These discoveries would have been welcome news to Katharina Schroth, a teenager who lived in Dresden, Germany in the early 1900s. Schroth had been diagnosed with scoliosis, a sideways curvature of the spine. The condition had no cure, and most children who suffered from it could expect to spend a life in bed or rolling around in a wheelchair. But Schroth had other thoughts about the human body's potential. She'd watched how balloons collapsed or expanded, pushing or pulling in whatever was around them. The lungs, she felt, were no different. If she could expand her lungs, maybe she could also expand her skeleton. Maybe she could straighten her spine and improve the quality and quantity of her life. At age 16, Schroth began training herself in something called orthopedic breathing. She would stand in front of a mirror, twist her body, and inhale into one lung while limiting the air in the other. Then she'd hobble over to a table, sling her body on its side, and arch her chest back and forth to loosen her ribcage. Schroth spent 5 years doing this. At the end, she'd effectively cured herself of incurable scoliosis. She'd breathed her spine straight again. Schroth began teaching the power of breathing to other scoliosis patients, and by the 1940s, she was running a bustling institute in Western Germany. It had no hospital rooms or other standard medical equipment, just a few run-down buildings, a yard, and some patio tables. 150 scoliosis patients would gather there at a time. They suffered from the most severe form of the disease, with spines curved more than 80 degrees. Many were so hunched over, their backs so twisted and turned, that they couldn't walk or even look upward. Their disfigured ribs and chests made it hard for them to take a breath. Hospitals had given up on these people. They came to live with Schroth for 6 weeks. The German medical community derided Schroth, claiming that she was neither a professional trainer nor physician and was not qualified to treat patients. She ignored them all. She kept doing things her way, having the women stripped down bare-chested in a dirt lot, stretching and breathing themselves back to health. Then a few weeks, hunched back straightened, and many students gained inches in height. Women who had been bedridden and hopeless finally began to walk again. They could take full breaths again. Schroth spent the next 60 years bringing her techniques to hospitals throughout Germany and beyond. Towards the end of her life, the medical community had changed its tune. The German government awarded her the Federal Cross of Merit for her contributions to medicine. What the bodily form depends on is breath, and what breath relies on is form, states a Chinese adage from 700 AD. When the breath is perfect, the form is perfect. Schroth continued to expand her lungs and improve her own breathing and form throughout her life. This former scoliosis patient, who as a teenager had been left to wither in bed, would die in 1985, just 3 days shy of her 91st birthday. Midway through my research for this book, I took a trip to New York City to meet a more contemporary breathing expert who offered a different approach to expanding the lungs and longevity. Her apartment workplace was located a few blocks from the United Nations in a brown brick building. I walked past a drowsy doorman, rode up an elevator, and a minute later, I was knocking on room 418. Lynn Martin welcomed me in. She was beanpole thin and dressed in a black jumpsuit with an oversized belt. "I told you it was small," she said of the studio apartment. Surrounding us were manila folders, human anatomy books, and a few plastic models of human lungs. On a wall beside a bookshelf were black and white photos of Martin in the early 1970s. In one, she was wearing a black leotard, her blonde hair pulled back in a lazy ponytail, her face bearing an uncanny resemblance to Mia Farrow's. After a few pleasantries, Martin sat me down and started telling me what I came to hear. He was very verbal, but when you asked what exactly he was doing, he could never explain it, she said. The subject of intrigue was Carl Stau, a choir conductor and medical anomaly who got his start in the 1940s. Of all the pulmonauts I've come across over the past several years, Stau was the most elusive. He published one book in 1970, which quickly flopped and went out of print. 20 years later, a CBS producer put together a one-hour program about him, but it never aired. Stau himself didn't advertise. He never went on speaking tours. Even so, professional opera singers, Grammy-winning saxophonists, paraplegics, and dying emphysemics, thousands of them, managed to find him. Stau broke all the rules. He expanded lungs and extended lifespans, and yet most people today had never heard of him. Martin had worked with Stau for more than 2 decades. She was a living link to this mysterious man and his research in the lost art of breathing. What Stau had discovered and what Martin had learned was that the most important aspect of breathing wasn't just to take in air through the nose. Inhaling, that was the easy part. The key to breathing, lung expansion, and the long life that came with it was on the other end of respiration. It was in the transformative power of a full exhale. Photographs of Stau from the 1940s show an upright man who bore a passing resemblance to Thurston Howell III, that millionaire from Gilligan's Island. Stau liked to sing, and he liked to teach singing. He noticed how his fellow singers would belt out a few measures, stop to take a breath, and then belt out a few more. Each seemed to be gasping for air, holding it high in the chest and releasing it too soon. Singing, talking, yawning, sighing, all of it. Any vocalization we make occurs during the exhalation. Stau's students had thin and weak voices because, he believed, they had thin and weak exhalations. Stau began training his students to exhale properly, to build up their respiratory muscles and enlarge their lungs. Within a few sessions, they were singing clear, more robustly, and with added nuance. He then moved to North Carolina to conduct church choirs that went on to win national championships. Stau became so renowned that he transferred to New York to retrain singers of the Metropolitan Opera. In 1958, the administration of the East Orange VA Hospital in New Jersey called. "You must know something about breathing that we don't," said Maurice Small, the chief of tuberculosis management. Small was wondering if Stau might be interested in training a new group of students. None of them could sing, and a few couldn't walk or talk. They were emphysema patients, and they were in desperate need of help. When Stau arrived at the hospital a few weeks later, he was horrified. Dozens of patients were laid out on gurneys, each one jaundiced and pale, their mouths craned open like fish, oxygen tubes pumping to no avail. The hospital staff didn't know what to do, so they just wheeled the men across the waxed terrazzo floor into a communal room hung with American flag clocks and tissue dispensers. One after the other, all these men, just lying there, waiting to die. it had gone on this way for 50 years. I foolishly had assumed that everyone had at least a rudimentary knowledge of physiology, Stahl would write. Even more foolishly, I had assumed that a universal awareness of the importance of breathing existed. Nothing could have been farther from the truth. Emphysema is a gradual deterioration of lung tissue marked by a chronic bronchitis and coughing. The lungs become so damaged that people with the disease can no longer absorb oxygen efficiently. They're forced to take several short, sharp breaths very fast, often breathing in far more air than they need. But yet they still feel out of breath. Emphysema had no known cure. The nurses, meaning well, had placed cushions under the patients' backs so their chests were arched up. The idea was to create elevation to ease the inhalations. Stout instantly saw that this was making the condition worse. Emphysema, after all, is a disease of exhalation. The patients were suffering not because they couldn't get fresh air into their lungs, but because they couldn't get stale air out. Normally, the blood coursing through the arteries and veins does a full circuit once a minute, an average of 2,000 gallons of blood a day. What influences much of the speed and strength of this circulation is the thoracic pump, the name for the pressure that builds inside the chest when we breathe. As we inhale, negative pressure draws blood into the heart. When we exhale, blood shoots back out into the body and lungs, where it recirculates. It's similar to the way the ocean floods into shore and then ebbs out. What powers the thoracic pump is the diaphragm, the muscle that sits beneath the lungs in the shape of an umbrella. The diaphragm lifts during exhalations, which shrinks the lungs, then it drops back down to expand during inhalations. This up-and-down movement occurs some 50,000 times a day. The problem is, most of us only engage a small range of the diaphragm when breathing, which overburdens the heart, elevates blood pressure, and causes a rash of circulatory problems. Simply extending those breaths to 70 or even 50% of the diaphragm's capacity will ease the burden on the heart and allow the body to work more efficiently. For this reason, the diaphragm is sometimes referred to as the second heart, because it not only beats to its own rhythm, but also affects the rate and strength of the heartbeat. Stahl discovered that the diaphragms in all of his patients had broken down. X-rays showed they were using only a small fraction of the diaphragm's movement, taking in just sips of air with each breath. The patients had been ill for so long that many of the muscles and joints around their chests had atrophied and stiffened. They had no muscle memory of breathing deep. Over the next 2 months, Stahl reminded them how. My activities look silly when observed from a distance, and they seem silly at the outset to the person with whom I worked, wrote Stahl. He began his treatments by putting patients flat on their backs, running his hands across their torsos, and gently tapping on the rigid muscles and distended chests. He'd have them take in a big breath and count from 1 to 5 as many times in a row as they could. Next, he massaged their necks and throats and lightly coaxed their ribs as he told them to inhale and exhale very slowly, trying to wake the diaphragm from its long slumber. Each of these exercises allowed the patients to let out a little more air so that a little more air could get in. After several sessions, some patients learned to speak a full sentence in a single breath for the first time in years. Then the dead began to walk. One elderly man who had not been able to walk across the room not only could walk, but could walk up the hospital stairs, a remarkable feat for an advanced emphysema patient, Stahl would write. Another man who hadn't been able to breathe for more than 15 minutes without supplemental oxygen was lasting 8 hours. And another, who had suffered advanced emphysema for 8 years, was able to leave the hospital and captain a boat to Florida. Before and after X-rays showed that the patients were vastly expanding their lung capacity in only a few weeks. Even more stunning, they were training an involuntary muscle, that diaphragm, to lift higher and drop lower. Administrators told Stow that this was medically impossible. Internal organs and muscles cannot be developed, they said. At one point, several doctors petitioned to ban Stow from treating patients and kick him out of the hospital system. He was a choral teacher, not a doctor. But the x-rays didn't lie. To confirm his results, Stow began recording the first footage of a moving diaphragm using a new x-ray film technology. Everyone was floored. I told Carl in no uncertain words that he was mildly demented to say that he could affect a rise in the diaphragm and a descent in the ribs. But then, in one patient, we got rather spectacular results showing that he did do this, said Dr. Robert Nims, the chief of pulmonary medicine at the West Haven VA Hospital. Stow hadn't found a way to reverse emphysema. Lung damage from the disease is permanent. What he'd done is find a way to access the rest of the lungs, the areas that were still functioning, and then engage them on a larger level. The cure, Stow professed, was de facto, but it worked. Over the next decade, Stow would take his treatment to a half dozen of the largest VA hospitals on the East Coast, sometimes working on patients 7 days a week. He'd go on to treat not only emphysema, but asthma, bronchitis, pneumonia, and more. The benefits of breathing, of harnessing the art of exhalation, extended not just to the chronically sick or to singers. It benefited everyone. Back in Lynn Martin's apartment, I was reawakening my own slumbering diaphragm on the living room futon. "This is not a massage," Martin said, making her point clear as she pressed a hand against my ribs. I drew soft and long breaths deep into my gut while Martin helped loosen my rib cage, trying to coax at least 50% diaphragmatic movement in each inhale and each exhale. "Breathing this way wasn't necessary," Martin told me. "Our bodies can survive on short and clipped breaths for decades, and many of us do. That doesn't mean it's good for us. Over time, the shallow breathing will cave in the lungs and can lead to high-shouldered and neck-extended posture common in those with emphysema, asthma, and other respiratory problems. Fixing this breathing and this posture is relatively easy." After several rounds of deep breaths into my open rib cage, Martin asked me to start counting from 1 to 10 over and over again with every exhale. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. At the end of the exhale, when I was so out of breath that I couldn't vocalize anymore, I was to keep counting, but to do so silently, letting my voice trail down to a sub-whisper. I ran through a few rounds, counting quickly and loudly, then silently. At the end of each breath, it felt like my chest had been plastic wrapped. "Keep going," Martin said. The strain of this counting exercise is equivalent to the strain on the lungs during physical exertion. That's what made it so effective for Stow's bedridden patients. The point was to get the diaphragm accustomed to this wider range so that deep and easy breathing became unconscious. A few more minutes of this counting silent and otherwise, and I felt my diaphragm chugging away like a piston in slow motion, radiating fresh blood from the center of my body. This is the feeling of what Stow called breathing coordination, when the amount of air that enters us equals the amount of air that leaves us, and our bodies are able to perform all their essential functions with the least exertion. In 1968, Stow left the VA system and his thriving private practice in New York to train yet another group of students. These people could talk, and they could walk, and they could run very fast. They were the members of the Yale track and field team, among the best in the nation at the time. When Stow arrived at the track field house, the athletes were so excited that they hung a poster on the bulletin board outside. It read, "Dr. Breath is here today." Stow had expected these elite athletes to have exemplary breathing habits. Instead, he found they suffered from the same problems as everybody else, They got the same colds, the same flus, and the same lung infections. Sprinters were the worst off. The short and violent breaths they took during runs put too much pressure on the delicate tissues of their lungs. As a result, they suffered from asthma and other respiratory ailments. At the finish line, many coughed or sometimes vomited or collapsed, wheezing in pain. The runners had been trained to push through the pain, and they did. They won competitions, but they were also killing their lungs. Stow laid out a table at the Yale indoor track, sat the runners on it, and began running his hands up and down their chests in front of a group of onlookers. After only a few sessions, all the runners reported feeling better and breathing better. "I never felt so relaxed in my life," one sprinter said. They took half the time to recover between races and were soon edging towards world records. On the heels of the Yale success, Stow moved to South Lake Tahoe to train runners preparing for the 1968 Summer Olympics in Mexico City. Same therapy, same success. A decathlete went on to break his previous record. Another broke his lifetime record. A runner named Rick Sloan broke two life records for three events. "Through my work with Dr. Stow, I knew I had to exhale," said Lee Evans. "You know, I exhale, which kept my energy up. I didn't get tired, but after the game, I found that this was for my life." You might recognize Evans. He's the man in the famous photograph standing on the center podium of the Olympics awards ceremony, wearing a Black Panther beret and jutting a fist in the air. He won gold in the 400 meters and another in the 400-meter relay. The rest of the 1968 U.S. men's team under Stow's training went on to win a total of 12 Olympic medals, most gold, and set five world records. It was one of the greatest performances in any Olympics. The Americans were the only runners to not use oxygen before or after the race, which was unheard of at the time. But they didn't need to. Stow had taught them the art of breathing coordination and the power of harnessing a full exhalation. "He was doing so many things at once," Lynn Martin said as we moved from the futon back to the dining room table at the center of her apartment. "The sensitivity of his hands, perfect pitch of his ears, the natural knack for instruction, all of it." For the past few minutes, Martin has been telling me about her time working with Stow, how she'd gone to see him in 1975 and had come out feeling transformed. She returned a few weeks later and took a job at the clinic. Even though she would spend more than two decades working with him as one of his closest associates, Stow never told her his secrets. "He thought it was too difficult to put into words," she told me. I could relate. I'd seen a video recording of Stow at the 1992 Aspen Music Festival, perhaps the only existing footage that demonstrates what he did and how he did it. Stow was at the center of a conference room, a massage table in front of him. An open window looked out over copse of pine trees glowing white in the summer sun. Stow was deeply tanned and dressed in a black blazer with brass buttons and a pocket kerchief, as if he'd just flown in on a Concorde from Monte Carlo. He started off by inviting a tenor singer to lie on the table and then proceeded to jiggle the man's jaw, dig his hands into his waist, and rock him back and forth. "You see, I have to keep tapping right on the chest," said Stow, his yellow polka dot tie dangling in the singer's hair. This went on for several minutes until Stow leaned 3 inches from the man's face and began to count from 1 to 10 with him in a gibberishy harmony. "Everything's loosening very fast," Stow announced. He wiggled the man's hips and neck so violently that the singer almost fell off the table. It was a bizarre spectacle, and the grabbing and pushing and deep stroking looked at times like borderline molestation. After my own experience in Martin's studio, battling numbers and having my chest poked and my ribs squeezed, it became clear to me why Stow's work never caught on. It didn't matter that saxophonist David Sanborn, opera singers, Olympic runners, and thousands of other patients praised his treatments as a lifesaver. Stow wasn't a doctor. He was a self-made pulmonaut, a choir conductor. He was just too far out there. His methods were just too weird. Although the process of breathing involves both anatomy and physiology, neither branch of science has claimed it for thorough exploration, wrote Stow. It was a little-known territory waiting to be mapped and charted. Stow made his own map over a half-century of constant work, but when he died, that map was lost. As soon as he left the VA wards, so did his therapy. At the end of my two-hour session with Martin, I walked down 45th Street and hopped a train back to the airport. As we rumbled across the marshlands and over the Passaic River, I searched through the current treatments for the nearly 4 million Americans now suffering from emphysema. There were bronchodilators, steroids, and antibiotics. There was supplemental oxygen and surgery and something called pulmonary rehabilitation, which included assistance in quitting smoking, exercise planning, and nutrition counseling. But there was no mention of Stow, or the second heart of the diaphragm, or the importance of a full exhalation. No mention of how expanding the lungs and breathing properly had effectively reversed the disease or lengthened lives. Emphysema was still listed as an incurable disease.